State v. Nesmith, arguing for the petitioner, Timothy McMaster, arguing for the respondent, Sonia McCullough.
Morning, counsel. Are you ready to proceed today? And Mr. McMaster, I understand you're going to reserve 10 minutes in rebuttal. So the yellow light will go on with 10 minutes to go in your argument, and Ms. McCullen, 5-minute warning before the end of your... Okay, so you'll get a yellow light at that point. If you would proceed, please.
May it please the court, we're asking for this case to be remanded back to the district court with instructions to vacate the conviction and dismiss it without prejudice. No one's saying the state can't prosecute this case, they just have to do it right. This is a case, it's about basic fairness, common sense and basic fairness. Defendants should be told what they need, or what they need to be told to defend themselves, what the state has to prove in order to convict them. Those are the essential facts. In the Wheeler case, this court put forth an entirely workable test that basically if you go back to the old IRAP analysis, issue rule application conclusion, this is a case in which there's an awful lot of agreement. Everyone agrees that the issue is whether or not the complaint is legally sufficient or legally deficient. Everyone agrees what the rule is. It's in the Wheeler case. I call it the three high hills. It's whether or not the charge fully defines the offense in unmistakable terms, readily comprehensible to persons of common understanding. That's right out of the Wheeler case. Hill number one, did it fully define the charge? Two, in unmistakable terms. And three, these are not terms that are terms that can be inferred by knowledgeable and skillful justices on the ICA. I was in the avid district court earlier this week, and I looked out at the audience. I looked at the people that I rub shoulders with down there. This is about basic fairness to each of them, and telling each of them in terms that they can understand, readily comprehensible, fully defining for each of them what it is the state has to prove in order to convict them. I mean, the rule is also, what was Rule 7D. The charge has to be a plain, definite, concise statement of each of the essential facts constituting the offense charged. And it's just basic fairness that if you have to prove a mens rea, the complaint should mention something about it. Now, everyone agrees that the complaint in Mr. Nesmith's case and the other cases that you've taken cert on, it doesn't contain a single word about mens rea. I mean, this is a case about four words that should be mentioned in these complaints.
If you assume that the complaint did not allege the state of mind that you say is necessary, or states of mind that are necessary, could that have been remedied by an oral charge?
No, because DUI cases are a unique under the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure. DUI case, in many types of cases in which that type of a deficient charge was made as part of an oral charge, if the defendant objects or whatever and the prosecutor goes back and cleans up the charge and says he has to work, that can be immediately remedied. But here's the problem. A DUI case is required by Rule 7A of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure. You have a written complaint. The only DUI case, at least the type that we're concerned with here, in Mr. Nesmith's case, is a petty misdemeanor case. And take a look at Rule 7A. It's the only, and we mentioned this in our opening brief on the IC as well, it's the only type of a petty misdemeanor case. I have no idea why it was singled out as the sole and solitary case. But that's not up to me. That's in the Hawaii, I play by the rules of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure. And they say that there has to be a written complaint. So there has to be a written charge. I mean, this is what's fundamental. And that's why I respect this that it is a matter of jurisdiction. And the court talked about adequate notice. The real correct analysis here isn't subject matter jurisdiction. The rules require that you have to have a valid written charge to even get out of the starting blocks in the DUI case. And if you don't have a valid written charge, the only thing that the court can do at that point is dismiss. I'm not saying dismiss with prejudice. First, you say dismiss with prejudice. We defense attorneys always love that. But no, the fair result here is remand back to the district court and dismiss the case without prejudice. But that's exactly what the result was in the Wheeler case.
Mr. McMaster, the prosecution contends that
the complaint was sufficient because it laid out the elements of the crime, the elements being elements as defined by the Hawaii Penal Code. So how do you answer that?
I answer that by saying the rule of Rule 7D and the words of Rule 7D are the essential facts. That there should be a plain, definite, and concise statement of each of the essential facts possible to be charged. Your term essential facts is broader than mere elements. And actually, you can compare this. When the court used the word elements in the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure, it uses the word elements. Words essential facts, which is broader than elements, it uses the term essential facts. I forget which rule it is exactly, you can have a law clerk look for it, but there's another rule in the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure that actually refers to elements of the offense. And so I respectfully submit essential facts is a term that's broader.
Why did the ICA reject that argument?
The ICA actually agreed with, the first thing to understand is every, Mr. Nasmith's case is a case in which the 291E61 DUI statute has different alternative methods of proof. The A1 statute talks about whether or not you had impaired mental faculties and impaired ability to care for yourself and guard against casual. The A3 portion of the statute, and these are the two portions of the statute that were at issue in Mr. Nesmith's case, talks about whether or not you had a prohibited breath alcohol content, more than 0.08 grams of alcohol to 210 liters of breath. Now, the way the ICA dealt with the A1 charge was they agreed with Mr. McMaster's. They agreed that you have to prove the mens rea element with respect to an A1 charge. And remember, that's not just proving it. With respect to the intoxication element. That's the way it works, the basic principle of black letter principles of criminal law. You have to prove mens rea with respect to each essential element of the offense. So that includes not only the intoxication element, the impairment element, it also includes that it was done somewhere in the city of Yanibamulu, and it also includes the public roads or your highway element. So with respect to an A1, the ICA agrees with Mr. McMaster that you even have to prove the mens rea element that the offense was committed intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly.
Nobody disputes that you have to prove it, but the question is whether you have to allege it.
Well,
so
actually,
didn't the ICA reject that?
One reason that I thought that maybe I'm here today is because the ICA said that with respect, they made a distinction, Judge, between the A1 charge and the A3 charge. With respect to the A3 charge, prohibited breath alcohol content, they said the entire A3 method of proof, if you're using an A3 method of proof, the entire method of proof is strict liability.
Well, Mr. McMaster, could you stand at the podium? We are recording the proceedings, we're not able to record. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
So in any event, so basically they agreed with what I had to say about having to prove the mens rea element with respect to the A1 charge. But they said the legislature had intended the A3, it was a committee report in a case from 1982. And they
said, sticking with A1, because A1 goes specifically, based on your position, to the charge.
Yeah, everyone agrees you have to prove it with respect to A1.
So how do you answer that? The ICA apparently didn't think there was any problem with the A1 charge.
The problem with the ICA is it didn't follow what you guys had to say in Wheeler. What this court had to say in Wheeler was that the complaint must fully define the offense in unmistakable terms that are readily, and this is the most important of it, the third prong. Your third prong is a great one. You don't have to change a word of it. Readily comprehensible to persons of common understanding. So that I can meet out in the audience and we have a district court, and I can see 10 people, and all you got to do is hand them a complaint, and they're going to be able to read it using their common knowledge and understanding, and understand this is what the state has to prove to convict me. Now, what the ICA said is that you can hand any of those people in the gallery at the other district court a complaint that doesn't contain a word about a mental state, and that they're going to reasonably infer from the language of the complaint that a mental state would have to be proved.
Isn't that exactly what we held in the Torres case? So in other words, we've held that if the vermin or the charge tracks the statute, which this one did here, you can look at the language of the charge and in particular circumstances believe or come to the conclusion that a recipient of that charge could reasonably infer that intent was being charged. The analysis here, I guess, by the ICA is that you would reasonably infer that they would knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly be operating a vehicle while under the influence.
My response to that is once again, this is really about the whole thing. And Rule 2 of the Wire Rules of Penal Procedure says all the rules are supposed to be interpreted to promote the fair and just and efficient administration of justice. This is based apparently.
Mr. McMaster, if simply looking at the act, you can infer a particular state of mind. In Taurus, I think it was incest. But so what state of mind what state of mind would you infer from driving? Let's take A1 first, right? Driving under the influence. What state of mind would you infer? Just answer my question. What state of mind would you infer?
It's a difficult question for me to answer because as a lawyer, I'd immediately infer that it's a general intent situation. You have to have at least, I went to law school and they drilled it into my head that there has to be at least some conscious element of wrongdoing before I will suffer a criminal penalty. And actually, if you take a look at the commentary, what is it? 702.12.
Well, how would you come to infer, just from the act of driving under the influence, that the state of mind required to be proven and that you're charged with would be intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly?
I don't think I would infer. To be perfectly honest, if I hadn't had a law school education and I read one of those complaints, I wouldn't infer anything. I really wouldn't.
If you argue that you can infer simply from the act the state of mind required, then what about negligently? Because the penal code includes negligently,
yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And what I was trying to
say. So why would someone looking at the particular act be restricted to just three of the four states of mind in the penal code?
No reason whatsoever, you know. It's an excellent point that you're making. I want to highlight it by saying in reality it happens all the time.
Well, Torres and the other cases, they're all based on the idea of general intent, right?
Yes, Judge.
Under general intent, you look at the act. From the act, you infer a wrongful state of mind.
One of my attorney colleagues said, argue that stuff to him about malum in se, malum prohibitum, because I sort of remember something back in law school about how certain acts are just so evil in and of themselves.
Now, general intent has been abolished in this jurisdiction,
right?
The concept.
That's right. And actually, we've got 702.204 that's a statutory. That's the essence of my argument.
Wasn't Torres a model penal code case, so after the abolishment of general intent? Wasn't Torres a model penal code case 1983? And did it not address this situation
I don't recall when exactly we brought in the whole model penal code stuff.
Let me ask you this. In your view, is Torres wrongly decided, and do we have to over...
Yes, it's wrongly decided. Absolutely, Torres is wrongly decided. It's time to take to re-examine this in terms of basic fairness. And this is just common sense stuff. I'm talking to you like a four-year-old stuff.
By the time Torres was decided, Kalama hadn't been decided. So at that point, the law in this jurisdiction didn't say it, although the penal code did say.
Absolutely.
That general intent and specific intent are no longer applicable.
Yes.
Can you explain, in every indictment we look at, practically every indictment we look at, the indictment sets out the elements of the crime, that is, the elements as defined in the penal code, conduct, attendant circumstances, forget what the third one was. Even though that's all the penal code sets up, when we look at these various charging documents, they all set out the state of mind. even though the Hawaii Penal Code says state of mind is not an element. So why, in this particular situation, in, say, A1, why is it that these defendants don't get the benefit of a charging document that sets out the requisite state of mind to be proven, when in most other situations, those defendants get the benefit of being told what state of mind is being charged? What's the rational basis for distinguishing, say, in this case, the person who's charged with driving under the influence, as opposed to someone charged with any other petty misdemeanor or any other felony?
I would recommend everybody should be told, Judge. Everyone should be told, right there in the charging language. And in a way, that the test is not what you reasonably infer by three knowledgeable and skilled judges on the ICA or 501. The test is all those people that I was able to get to this report. And what I was trying to tell you is that easily 50% of them sit across the desk from me, want to come, if you are charged with an A1, want to come in and come in.
Mr. McMaster, again, I just have to ask you if you could stay at the podium, and I think it also helps us in following your argument if you could stay there. So, again, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Judge.
No, I appreciate it.
So, I want to get at the other part of what the I. So, everyone agrees that with respect to the A1 at least, and that's with respect to each essential element, you have to prove state of mind on an A1 charge with respect to the public highway through your element, believe it or not. If you should have known better, but you didn't, should have known, you know, classic negligence, your negligence. That's a total defense on an A1 if you thought you were driving in your backyard as opposed to on a public road through the highway. Because remember, they have to prove each essential element of the crime, and then they have to prove the mens rea with respect to each one. And public way, roads, street, or highway is an element with respect to both an A1 and an A3 charge. Now, it is somewhat inconsistent that you therefore don't have to prove the mens rea with respect to public way, road, street, or highway. The other thing, too, is somebody just, because I'm running out of time, I'm going to say, there's always the spiked punch argument. Well, I'll back up. With respect to the A3 charge, the ICA's, what did come up with a somewhat consistent opinion on that, simply say, hey, we think that the entire A3 portion of the charge is strict liability, absolute liability. And so therefore, if you don't have to prove it, you don't have to charge it. Now, some of the cases you've taken cert on, one in particular, Soria, is just a singular A1 case. Nesmith is an A3 case. We're going to argue the A3 stuff here. If you take a look, now, this is arguably throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You guys can write an opinion that says, oh, we think the legislature did, and it might even be consistent with some of that old stuff from 1983. I remember the 80s, they were good. I enjoyed the 80s. But you don't have to say the entire A3 method of proof is strict liability. If you read 702.212, it makes it clear that a singular element of an offense.
Does that help your case? That argument?
I'm sorry?
Does that argument help your case, help your client?
The singular element of having a prohibited breath alcohol content might have been intended by the legislature. I respectfully submit none of it was.
Well, the ICA, though, said that A3 is a strict liability offense. In other words, you do the act, whatever you thought is irrelevant. Is that correct?
Exactly. If you have
so that that would mean
on a public way or street or highway with prohibited breath alcohol content. If you have your driving car on a public way or street or highway with a prohibited breath alcohol content, then yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what was in your head at that time. You could be driving under the influence of spiked punch, and it wouldn't matter what was in your head at that time. The legislature intended that to be the whole thing.
So if you accept the ICA's position that A3 is a strict liability offense, then the fact that the driver didn't know that he was driving on a public road would not make any difference, would it?
That's right, you got it.
Or else in A1, the fact that he didn't know he was driving on a public road would result in, if the prosecution didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, an acquittal.
How inconsistent. Absolutely. I agree entirely.
And Judge Mr. Nesmith, McMaster, wasn't your client, isn't Nesmith also both A1 and A3?
Yes, he's A1 and A3.
Okay.
Okay. And the point I was trying to make before is that you've accepted cert on about 7 or 8 of these cases I put up. And there is one of them, Soria, that is a singular A1 case. So that's one you want to take a close look at.
Mr. McMaster, didn't the legislature recodify the statute in 2000 after there had already been judicial decisions interpreting the predecessor as being a strict liability offense? And doesn't that, at least in the ICA's view, suggest that the legislature intended this result and it doesn't?
Right, because the legislature was so conscious of what the case law was prior to that. And I respectfully submit that the best place to look for what the legislature's intent was in 2000 is what the plain meaning of all the language in the statute. If they wanted to make it an absolute liability offense, they could have said absolute liability, strict liability, no matter what. They could have found some phrase that would have worked. Two, if you look at the commentary, that 702.212 is the statute that authorizes the legislature to create strict liability criminal offenses. 702.212, it's an important one. Read the commentary to it. It says a crime defined by statute other than this code insofar as the legislative purpose to impose absolute liability for such offense or with respect to any element. So I said, well, you know, you don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You could say, yeah, I mean, although we respectfully disagree that there's no legislative intent to make any of it strict liability, but you might conclude that there was a legislative intent to make just the singular element of breath alcohol content, but not public way, road, street type, or highway, not any of the rest of it. Then they have to prove it all beyond reasonable.
Does that help your case?
I respectfully submit it does, because
your client was driving down. Your client didn't know he was driving on a public road.
I'm not talking about what the proof of the facts would have been in Mr. Ness in this case, and I rarely, quite frankly, ever get to represent anyone who's unjustly accused. But a valid case starts with a valid charge. And so, anyway, I wanted to read you the commentary real quick before we give the other side a chance to address it. Subsection 2 provides for an extremely limited situation. The code takes the general position that absolute or strict liability in the penal law is indefensible in principle if conviction results in the possibility of imprisonment and condemnation. And there's always the possibility in the first offense DUI, you get 2 to 5 days in jail. And then subsection 2 severely limits, at the very end of the commentary, it says, subsection 2 severely limits the situations which will allow the imposition of absolute criminal liability by statutes outside the penal code. So, I mean, this whole model penal code system that we have is one that's based on the basic general principle of fairness, that we don't tar and feather people with a criminal conviction on their record for the rest of their lives unless it was some conscious element of wrongdoing on their part. At the very least, they had to have consciously disregarded a known and substantial possibility that they were driving a motor vehicle, doing it on a public railroad, street, or highway, and then doing it either, incidentally, out of the A1. You can be guilty on an A1 with less than an O8 in your blood or breath if you had impaired mental faculties or an impaired ability to care for yourself and to guard against casualty.
But Mr. McMasters, if we follow your argument, then the legislature shouldn't be allowed to create strict liability statutes any penal.
No, Judge 702.212 says that they are explicitly allowed to do that. But when they do it, they should clearly manifest the intent to do it. I would suggest some plain language to the extent of, and this is an absolute liability offense. You just can't get on at the end of, no one shall drive it. And this is at war with respect to the element of, this is an absolute liability offense. That's the way the legislature plainly and clearly, the words here are, what is it, clear and plain and all the rest of that stuff. So, once again, we can look at committee reports from 1982, I can quote you commentaries to statutes and stuff, but really, I mean, what this case is about, what you decide here won't necessarily only apply in DUI cases. I want you to consider for a second the intentional speeding cases as well, because those are also cases that they never charge any mens rea. And actually, there is some legal authority that says that they have to prove mens rea on the intentional speeding, I'm talking about the excessive speeding cases. 291C-105, excessive speeding. Easily, three quarters of people who sit across the desk from me in a client intake interview want to tell me that, Mr. McMaster, I had no idea I was going that fast. And if we turn it into a reasonable inference thing, you know, it's just, it's a slippery slope. It's a slippery slope.
I may not have caught, I don't think I caught the tail end of your argument regarding, even if we were to say that the legislature could have meant that there was strict liability only as to one element, that your client
The charge is still, thank you very much. The charge is still defective because the state needed to prove the mens rea with respect to the public way, road, street, or highway element. And that's what, you know, Justice Acoba immediately realized, how inconsistent that is, that somehow the legislature intended to get approved under an A1 method, public way, road, street, or highway with mens rea. That's what the ICA says. They agree with me on that. When they look at the A3 charts, they say, oh no, the entire baby, bath, water, everything goes out. Because you don't have to mens rea with respect to anything. If you're charging an A3, that's the way they interpret it. It's not the way the legislature intended it, and it's not the way it ought to be.
I don't think the ICA, I'm sorry.
No, I just, your time is, I know you're well into your time, but if Justice Cove has a question.
Just a comment. I don't think the ICA agreed with you on A1.
I have to respect, they agreed that we have to prove mens rea with respect to that's the way I read.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. McMaster. Ms. McCullen.
Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Sonia McCullen on behalf of the State of Hawaii. The state respectfully requests that this court affirm the defendant's conviction of operating a vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant for two reasons. First, the conviction is factually sound. The defendant stipulated to drinking six beers, driving his truck on the Likeleke Highway, failing the field sobriety test, and blowing a .126 on his breathalyzer test. These facts satisfy every element of the charged OBUI offenses. Second, the conviction is legally sound because subsection A3 of HRS 291E-61 is an absolute liability offense. Therefore, state of mind is not required.
Does that mean that the defenses, the self-induced intoxication defense under 702-230 is not available to an A3 charge? Okay, 702-230 is the intoxication, it refers to intoxication and it says self-induced intoxication is prohibited as a defense except as provided, and it says evidence of the non-self-induced or pathological intoxication of a defendant shall be admissible to prove or negative conduct or prove state of mind sufficient to establish an element of the offense. I'm just curious, is 702-230 used in these cases?
I'm not familiar with that. I apologize.
Okay.
But based on what you read, if it negates a state of mind, I would say no, state of mind is not, does not apply.
If the defendant was intoxicated without his or her knowledge because someone slipped something into their drink, is it the state's position that they would not be able to rely on the statute that Justice McKenna just cited if they're pulled over and stopped, even though they had no conscious awareness that they were intoxicated or becoming intoxicated or had been given whatever the substance was?
As I understand A3 now, should a person, such as this defendant, who blew a .126 on the breathalyzer test and then gets behind his wheel of his truck and drives on a leaky highway, he has committed the A3 offense.
In other words, even, okay, I understand the stipulation in this case, but if it was spiked punch and one didn't know that, I guess it might be a little difficult to imagine how one could be .08 and not know
there's
it.
There's knowledge in the drinking of a drink and the taste of a drink.
Even if you didn't know that, that beverage would have the, or whatever you, what that substance would have the effect of causing you to become intoxicated or bringing you to the BAC level, that you would be found guilty of the offense. That would not be a defense?
Again, I'm not exactly familiar with that statute.
Okay, let's just assume the statute exists. 230 says pathological intoxication and non-voluntary intoxication are defenses. Then if you treat A3 as a strict liability offense, then would you be able to assert those defenses under an A3 charge?
You probably could assert it as a defense.
You do. If you can do that, then doesn't that make A3 not a strict liability offense? Because all strict liability requires is that you do the act.
I feel better if I read the statute, if I was more familiar with the statute too, that statute.
I have one other question. In terms, we can put it in the category of due process, but just common sense and fairness to people who are charged with crimes. In practically every offense, whether it's, even if the penal code says it's not an element, all the charging documents set out the required state of mind to be proven. The state takes the position that you don't have to, and the ICA did, set out the state of mind for this particular offense. Why? What's the rational basis for hiding or not setting forth the required state of mind when we do it in every other offense, or practically every other offense, unless it's a strict liability offense?
Are we discussing the A1, the A3, or the entire?
You can take it at A1 or A3, but pretty much it fits in with A1.
The state of mind is not in the statute itself. It's not in the language of the statute itself, the OBUII statute. It's actually through inference from another statute, the default statute.
Is that a reason not to include it in the charging document?
It's not a reason, no.
But then why is it not done?
It tracks the language of the charging as it's done. Tracks the language of the statute. It provides notice of the offense, and so.
Does it provide notice of the state of mind that must be proven at trial?
Inferentially.
Inferentially. How inferentially?
According to the ICA opinion, it's to inference of the conduct itself, the act of driving.
And they use general intent, and we've already said general intent and specific intent are out the window.
I don't recall the ICA. Did the ICA actually say general intent? Perhaps.
I think they said general intent, but they also relied on cases that relied on general intent.
Correct.
So if they're out the window, then how can you infer a state of mind from the act itself?
Well, I think where they were going from that was the conduct itself, the act of driving, getting behind your vehicle, turning on the car, the act of driving itself is something you know you're doing while you're doing it. And
from that you can infer a person of ordinary intelligence could infer four different states of mind and decide that out of the four, only three apply?
I think looking at the offense itself, the driving operating a vehicle under the influence of intoxicating liquors, in an amount sufficient to impair,
Would a person know, I'm sorry, that if he only did it negligently, that he would be acquitted from what you charge?
If the state cannot prove as to the A1.
Would the person who's charged know that that's a defense?
No.
Well, let me ask you this. Is intent an essential element under our case law or not?
No.
Okay, and how does that matter to the analysis here?
Well, under the Wheeler analysis that defendant inserts into his argument, it's a jurisdictional analysis under Wheeler, and an element, if it's missing from the charge, the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction. As to this case, state of mind is not an element. And so, jurisdictionally, it's sound.
Well,
the court has jurisdiction.
I just wanted to ask if you would. There's a passage in our MITA decision that cites Wheeler that says, the relevant inquiry, therefore, is whether or not the charge provided the accused with fair notice of the essential elements. In your view, did the charge here provide the defendant with fair notice of the essential elements?
Most definitely. I do believe so. The conduct.
And why is that?
By the language of the charge itself. It states, operate or assume actual control of a vehicle on a public way, street, road under the influence sufficient to impair his mental faculties. I think any person in the street reading this charge would know they're being charged with drunk driving.
You know, just looking at the ICA's rationale, that the statute, the penal code says the elements of a charge are, and then goes to conduct, attendant circumstances, I keep forgetting the third. Those are the elements. So elements in that sense is used in a special term. It's a term of art because it refers to a specific statute which says under the penal code we have designated these specific items as being elements. But if you look at the older cases, element, the state of mind is referred to as an element of the charge. You agree with that?
No. Clinch to Carolina.
Jenrich, Faulkner, and I forget that there's another one. Refers to a state of mind as an element that must be charged. And Jenrich said you had to charge a state of mind, intent to cause physical inconvenience to a crowd or to someone else. And the failure to charge that state of mind made the complaint defective because it was an element of the offense. And as a result, the court had no jurisdiction because no offense was charged.
Well,
how do you distinguish Jenrich?
Well, if it's in the statute itself, yes, it has to be included in the charge. So if state of mind is in the statute, it does have to be included in the charge.
Okay. And so if we look at the charge here, the state of mind has to be proven, right?
Correct.
And the penal code says when the state of mind isn't listed in the offense, then you go to 702-204. So in effect, the statute, the penal code incorporates the state of mind into those offenses which don't specifically set out the state of mind. You agree with that?
Yes, by inference they do incorporate.
By inference, not by inference, sorry. It says these states of mind apply to offenses which do not specifically or expressly list the state of mind.
Yes, it does.
So in effect, you have to read those two provisions together, right?
Correct.
So that, in effect, that becomes part of the offense. The state of mind becomes part of the offense.
Again, I guess we differ in that respect. I would say by inference, it does become something that an ingredient that the
You have to prove it. You have to prove it.
Correct, yes.
Shouldn't the, going back to due process again, shouldn't the defendant know that?
Yeah.
We do it in every other case. Then why isn't it charged then in this particular offense?
It appears from the language of the statute itself, or sorry, from the charge, that it tracks the statute and that it provides notice to the defendant of the offense he's being charged with. And so under Wheeler, it was deemed, or it appears sufficient. And in that manner, that's the best answer I can give you as to why it's not put in there. It appears sufficient as to Wheeler in that line of cases.
You mentioned the Kling case.
Yeah.
Okay, is that case reconcilable with the Faulkner and Gendrich cases, or is it, which should we look to, or are they reconcilable, or if they're irreconcilable, which should we look to?
It doesn't appear that state of mind is an element. I would look to the Kling case. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. I believe it's the latter. And the cases that I looked at, when state of mind was included in the charge, and the charge was in question, the sufficiency of the charge, the state of mind was actually part of the offense.
Well, a state of mind is always a part of the offense, right? Unless it's a strict liability.
Sorry, offense. In the language of the offense. I should be more clear.
What about the point made by counsel here that it doesn't make sense to treat A3 as a strict liability offense, because if you treat it as a strict liability offense, that means that you would in effect create two classes of defendants, because under A1, the fact that the person didn't know he was driving on a public road would result in an acquittal. But under A3, in the same circumstance, because the state of mind is irrelevant under a strict liability view, he would be convicted. Is that fair, just, or
that's how it's been treated as to the conduct element for many years. Under A1, state of mind was required for conduct, the conduct of driving. Under A3, it was not. It's been the practice.
Are you familiar with the Rushing case and the Eastman case?
Sorry, go on.
Those cases rejected a strict liability approach where the statute did not set out a state of mind. So, and those cases, well, it's difficult to ask you questions if you aren't familiar with it. But those cases set out several principles. One was that the fact that a state of mind is not mentioned doesn't mean that there's a strict liability offense. Second, that the legislature can expressly state that there's a strict liability offense. And the commentary to the strict liability statute says that it would be, words to the effect, it would be unjust to apply a strict liability approach if someone is subject to imprisonment. And so, therefore, it refers to a strict liability offense not in terms of recognizing that there should be, but as a only as a limitation. And we give a strict, our approach is to, when we look at statutes, strictly construe them, because it would be contrary to the primary objectives of the penal code that bases liability on moral culpability. So in this situation, what would make this a strict liability offense?
Well, it's a strict liability offense because the for one, the legislature implemented objective means of proving intoxication by or impairment by scientifically measuring the amount of alcohol in the blood. And second, the appellate courts in this case, or sorry, the appellate courts, with regards to this method of proving impairment, scientific method of improving impairment, the appellate courts in this state have held repeatedly that as to the OVUI offense, or the former DUI offense, strict liability does apply when using this scientific method. And in the 23 years since that first case, stating as such, the legislature made no changes to correct. And in that time, the legislature made approximately 15 amendments to these statutes and twice addressed the judicial interpretation of this statute on other matters, but not once said the court's interpretation of absolute liability was incorrect.
We use that proposition, but it's just one of the factors in interpreting a statute, right? Because the legislature was never squarely presented, as we are today, with the question of whether or not it's a strict liability offense. I mean, the legislature was not squarely set, well, nothing was squarely set before the legislature that said, okay, we have a choice, make this a strict liability offense or not a strict liability offense.
Not from my meeting.
Is it your position or the state's position that it's strict liability with regard to whether they're on a public roadway or road or highway?
Yes, I think the term public may be a little misleading because when I read the definition for public way, street, road, or highway, it's defined as every road, alley, street, way, right-of-way, lane, trail, highway, or bridge. It says every one of these. And then it goes on to say, and it includes parking lots, if any part thereof are open to the public. So I think defendant's definition or analysis of using public and that should not be a strict liability would be inaccurate because the definition itself connotes every road.
Like a Jeep trail in the middle of nowhere, if someone's driving on that Jeep trail?
It says every trail. That's what the definition says.
So whether they understand the definition or understand that it's a road or not, if yeah. they're on that road, they're strictly liable. That's the state's position.
Defendant 7D argument. Defendant raises 7D, HRPP Rule 7D, and in raising Rule 7D, the defendant mixes in the jurisdictional requirements of State v. Wheeler. And the state, I propose that 7D has to be looked at on its own, in this case, without State v. Wheeler, because it doesn't involve an element. It involves state of mind has been determined not to be an element. And
are there any cases referring to intent as a fact under the penal code?
No, not that I could find. Not that my research produced.
Thank you.
Would you agree essential facts would be everything that would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, I believe that's a reasonable interpretation.
So state of mind would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes.
So state of mind would be an essential fact. So state of mind would be an essential fact.
Yes.
So you are conceding then that under A1, the intent had to be in the complaint as a fact.
It was in by inference, according to if you look at the conduct. And the conduct infers?
As a general intent?
I wouldn't say a general intent.
Okay. Just so we're clear, your position, the state's position is that pursuant to Rule 7D, intent is an essential fact or a fact that has to be included in the charge?
No. Well, it was included in the charge.
And it was, in fact, included here. I just want to be sure that's the state's position, is it does have to be included, and, in fact, it was included here?
It was included, yeah.
But not stated in the complaint?
Not literally, no.
Why wouldn't you be able to infer negligence as a state of mind? If you can infer a state of mind, I mean, why not negligence?
I think it goes to the conduct, you know, you're driving when you're driving. I
mean, couldn't it be negligent as opposed to reckless, knowing, and intentional?
I think a reasonable person knows they're doing the act of driving while they're doing it.
You had an 803 or 806 argument, too?
In its answering brief, the state did.
And that argument was what?
That argument was that 806-28 applies, but I submit it doesn't.
So you, okay, you're now, 806 does not apply to district court.
The state
court.
Concedes 806 doesn't apply.
Okay, thank you.
806-28 does not apply.
All right, thank you.
Assuming it did apply, do you have the language of the statute in front of you?
No, I do. I believe I do.
Sorry. Can you read it?
The indictment need not allege that the offense was committed or the act was done feloniously, unlawfully, willfully, knowingly, maliciously, with force and arms, or otherwise, except where such characterization is used in the statutory definition of defense.
So if you read states of mind being incorporated into offenses where there is no stated or expressed state of mind, then you could apply it. Then that statute would not apply. It's okay. I think I got the answer. Thank you.
Well, if the court has no further questions, I'd like to reiterate that the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. It's factually sound. A3 is a strict liability offense. It can be upheld under that. And A1. State of mind was included in the charge, charging instrument by reference, and assuming arguendo this court finds that it was not, the state would show that there is no evidence in the record of prejudice as required, that would be required under 7D. And thank you for your time.
Mr. McMaster, how much time does Mr. McMaster have left?
3 minutes and 55 seconds, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, everyone seems to be agreeing that the phrase essential facts should be interpreted as facts that you have to prove in your conviction.
Mr. McMaster, does 7D require prejudice, as Ms. McCollum said?
Judge, I respectfully submit that every time is not told right off the bat with a valid criminal complaint what has to be true. There's prejudice inherent in that. As well as, I respectfully submit, it really is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. You don't even get out of the starting blocks in a criminal case. It's as if they had filed a complaint against Mr. Nesmith that said, on or about such and such a date in the city and county of Honolulu, Mr. Nesmith did intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly operate his motor vehicle on a public way, road, street, or highway. Period. And stopped. But where's the part about being under the influence of alcohol? chain to have a valid charge. All you got is a bunch of broken links.
So 7D is superfluous, you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all. 7D is an important rule, and it says that they have to charge each of the essential facts. And I told you right off the bat, I respectfully submit, it's both a there are both substantive notions of justice and procedural notions of justice. This is a procedural notion of justice. One of the young lawyers, Judge Yeoman, once looked at me and said, Mr. McMaster, the rules of civil procedure are a level playing field for all the parties. And the Hawaii rules of penal procedure are a level playing field for both the parties in a criminal case. And the state has to come in and file a proper criminal complaint containing a valid charge. The charge is the starting point of any criminal case. And if you don't have a valid charge, it's just like that theoretical plan is going, where you don't say anything about the under influence at all. It's broken, it's not a chance. So, as opposed to looking at the semantics that were used in this case or that case or another case from the past, this court should be focused, that's why I said the very first thing I said to you, is this is a case about basic fairness. This is the court's opportunity to craft language that really makes it clear that what we are talking about here is essential facts. People have a right to be told in basic common English what it is the state has to prove to convict them. With the remaining period of my time, there's anything it's just so, I haven't talked to Mr. Duffy, who was so pleasant, Justice Duffy, who was so pleasant for years. If there's anything Justice Duffy would like me to address, I'll use the remaining time to do that.
No, there isn't. I very much enjoyed seeing you after all these years, Mr. McMaster.
Nice.
Thank
you
for the opportunity.
Duffy. Very nice to see you as a justice on the Supreme
Court. I do have a question. Is 702.230 used in A3 cases?
It should apply in an A3 case. It rarely, as a practical matter, used in DUI defense. As a practical matter, rarely do we ever try to go in and convince the judge that our client was merely negligent, as opposed to practical matter, that is generally not the defense. But every once in a while, there is somebody sitting on the other side of the desk who wants to tell me, I just didn't have a clue. And I always feel duty-bound to explain to them, well, I think that technically is, there ought to be a defense. Probably ain't gonna fly. But, I mean, the rules are what the rules are. And this is about basic fairness. And the words you used in Wheeler were notice. I respectfully submit subject matter jurisdiction is the better analysis. But it all just comes down to basic fairness. People have a right to be told what it is the state has to prove in order to convict them.
Thank you very much, counsel, to both of you for your arguments today. And the court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.